Site 3, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 96.
I think there's a flaw here, Sophronia, Sparhawk said. Won't the Seeker come back just as soon as the smoke clears? I don't think an illusion would deceive it, would it?
The Seeker won't come back for at least a week, she assured him. It will be very, very ill.
Should I signal the troops manning the catapults? Alstrom asked.
Not yet, my lord. We have other things to do first. Timing is very important in this.
Beirut, I'll need a basin of water.
Yes, ma'am.
The novice went toward the stairs.
Very well, then, she continued. Let's get started.
She began patiently to instruct the church knights in the spell. There were Styric words Sparhawk had not learned before, and Sophronia adamantly insisted that each of them repeat them over and over, until pronunciation and intonation were absolutely perfect.
Stop that, she commanded at one point when Colton tried to join in.
I thought I could help, he protested.
I know just how inept you are at this, Colton. Just stay out of it.
All right, gentlemen, let's try it again. Once she was satisfied with their pronunciation, she instructed Sparhawk to weave the spell. He began to repeat the Styric words and to gesture with his fingers. The figure that appeared in the center of the room was vaguely amorphous, but it did appear to be wearing Pandion black armor.
You didn't put a face on it, Sparhawk, Colton pointed out.
I'll take care of that, Sophronia said.
She spoke two words and gestured sharply. Sparhawk stared at the shape before him. It was much like looking into a mirror.
Sophronia was frowning.
Something wrong? Colton asked her.
It's not too hard to duplicate familiar faces, she replied, or those of people who are actually present. But if I have to go look at the face of everybody in the castle, this could take days.
Would these help? Talon asked, handing her a sketch pad. She leafed through the pages, her eyes widening as she turned each page.
The boy's a genius, she exclaimed.
Curic, when we get back to Simera, apprentice him to an artist. That might keep him out of trouble.
It's only a hobby, Sophronia, Talon said, blushing modestly. You do know that you could make far more as a painter than as a thief, don't you? She said pointedly.
He blinked, and then his eyes narrowed speculatively.
All right, now it's your turn, Tinian, Sophronia told the Daeron.
After each had created a mirror image of himself, she led them to an embrasure overlooking the courtyard.
We'll build the large illusion down there, she told them. It might get a little crowded if we tried to do it up here.
It took them an hour to complete the illusion of a mass of armed and mounted men down in the courtyard. Then Sophronia went through Talon's sketchpad again and put a face on each figure. Then she made a broad sweep of her arm, and the images of the church knights joined the illusion below.
They aren't moving, Curic said.
Flute and I will take care of that, Sophronia told him. The rest of you will need to concentrate to keep the images from breaking up. You'll have to hold them together until they reach that forest over there.
Sparhawk was already sweating. Building a spell and then releasing it was one thing. Holding one in place was quite something else. He suddenly realized how much strain Sophronia was bearing. It was early afternoon by now. Sophronia looked out the embrasure at Count Jerek's troops.
All right, she said. I guess we're ready.
Signal the catapults, my lord, she said to Alstrom. The Baron took a piece of red cloth out from under his sword belt and waved it out of the embrasure. Below, the catapults began to thud, hurling their burning missiles over the wall and into the midst of the besieging army, while other engines showered the ships in the river. Even from this distance, Sparhawk could hear the soldiers coughing and choking on the dense cloud of lavender smoke coming from the burning balls of pitch, naphtha, and Sophronia's powder. The smoke rolled across the field in front of the castle, sparkling with that firefly glitter. Then, it engulfed the knoll where Jerek, Addis, and the Seeker were standing. Sparhawk heard an animal-like screech, and then the black-robed Seeker burst from the smoke, flogging its horse mercilessly. It seemed unsteady in its saddle, and it was holding the edge of its hood tightly across its face with one pale claw. The soldiers, who had been blocking the road leading from the castle gate, came reeling out of the smoke, coughing and retching.
All right, my lord, Sophronia said to Alstrom. Lower the drawbridge. Ostrom signaled again, this time with a green cloth. A moment later, the drawbridge boomed down.
Now, flute, Sophronia said, and began to speak rapidly in Styric, even as the little girl raised her pipes.
The massive illusory men in the courtyard, who had until now been rigidly immobile, seemed to come to life all at once. They rode out through the gate at a gallop and plunged directly into the smoke. Sophronia passed her hand over the basin of water Bayrit had brought to the tower and peered intently into it.
"Hold them, gentlemen," she said. "Keep them intact."
A half-dozen of Jerek's soldiers who had escaped from the smoke stood coughing, retching, and digging at their eyes on the causeway leading away from the castle. The illusory army rode directly through them. The soldiers fled, screaming.
"Now we wait," Sophronia said. "It's going to take a few minutes for Jerek to get his wits together and realize what seems to be happening down there."
Sparhawk heard startled shouts coming from below, and then bellowed commands.
"A little faster, flute," Sophronia said quite calmly. "We don't want Jerek to catch up with the illusion. He might begin to grow suspicious if his sword goes through the Baron here without any effect."
Ostrom was staring at Sophronia in awe.
"I would not have believed this possible, m'lady," he said in a shaking voice.
"It did turn out rather well, didn't it?" she said. "I wasn't entirely positive I could pull it off."
"You mean..."
"I've never done it before. But we can't learn without experimentation, can we?"
On the field below, Jerek's troops were scrambling into their saddles. Their pursuit was disorganized, a chaos of galloping horses and brandished weapons.
"They didn't even think to charge that open drawbridge," Euleth noted critically. "Very unprofessional."
"They aren't thinking very clearly just now," Sophronia told him. "The smoke does that to people. Are they all clear of the area yet?"
"There are a few still floundering around down there," Calton advised. "They seem to be trying to catch their horses."
"Let's give them time to get out of our way. Continue to hold the illusion, gentlemen," she said, looking into her basin of water. "It's still a couple of miles to those woods."
Sparhawk clenched his teeth.
"Can't you speed things up a bit?" he asked her. "This isn't easy, you know."
"Nothing worthwhile is ever easy, Sparhawk," she told him. "If the images of those horses start to fly, Jerek is going to get very, very suspicious, even in his present condition."
"Bayrit," Curic said, "you and Talon, come with me. Let's go down and get the horses ready. I think we all might want to leave in a hurry."
"I'll go with you," Ostrom said. "I want to talk with my brother before he leaves. I'm sure I've offended him, and I'd rather have us part friends."
The four of them went on down the stairs. "Just a few minutes longer now," Sophronia said. "We're almost to the edge of the woods."
"You look as if you just fell into a river," Calton said, glancing at Sparhawk's sweaty face.
"Oh, shut up," Sparhawk said irritably.
"There," Sophronia said finally. "Let it go now."
Sparhawk let out an explosive breath of relief and released the spell. Flute lowered her pipes and winked at him. Sophronia continued to look into her basin.
"Jerek's about a mile from the edge of the trees," she reported. "I think we should let him get well into the woods before we leave."
"Whatever you say," Sparhawk replied, leaning wearily against a wall.
It was about 15 minutes later when Sophronia set her basin on the floor and straightened.
"I think we can go down now," she said.
They descended to the courtyard where Curic, Talon, and Bayrit had the horses. The patriarch Ortsel, stiff-lipped and pale with anger, was with them, and his brother was at his elbow.
"I shall not forget this, Ostrom," he said, pulling his black ecclesiastical robe tighter about him.
"You may feel differently after you've had time to think about it. Go with God, Ortsel."
"Stay with God, Ostrom,"
Ortsel replied, more out of habit, Sparhawk thought, than from any real sense of emotion. They mounted and rode out through the gate and on across the drawbridge.
"Which way?" Calton asked Sparhawk.
"North," Sparhawk replied. "Let's get clear of this place before Jerek comes back.
That's supposed to be a number of days. Let's not take any chances."
They rode north at a gallop. It was late afternoon by the time they reached the shallow ford where they had first encountered Sir Enmon. Sparhawk reined in and dismounted. Let's consider our options, he said.
What precisely did you do back there, madame? Orzo was saying to Sophronia. I was in the chapel, and so I did not see what happened.
A bit of deception is all, your grace, she replied. Count Jarek thought he saw your brother and the rest of us escaping. He gave chase.
That's all?
He looked surprised.
You didn't?
He left it hanging.
Kill anybody?
No. I strongly disapprove of killing.
That's one thing we agree about, anyway. You're a very strange woman, madame. Your morality seems to coincide rather closely with that laid down by the true faith. I would not have expected that from a heathen. Have you ever given any thought to conversion?
She laughed. You too, your grace. Dolman's been trying to convert me for years now. No, Orzal, I'll remain faithful to my goddess. I'm far too old to change religions at this stage in my life.
Old, madame? You?
You wouldn't believe it, your grace, Sparhawk told him.
You have all given me much to consider, Orzal said. I have followed what I perceive to be the letter of church doctrine. Perhaps I should look beyond that perception and seek guidance from God.
He walked a ways upstream, his face lost in thought.
It's a step, Carlton muttered to Sparhawk. A fairly big one, I'd say.
Tinian had been standing at the edge of the shallow ford, looking thoughtfully toward the west.
I have a sort of an idea, Sparhawk, he said. I'm willing to listen.
Jarek and his soldiers are all searching that forest, and if Sophronia is right, the Seeker will be unable to give chase for at least a week. There won't be any enemies on the other side of this river.
That's true, I suppose. We should probably have a look around on the other side before we get overconfident, though.
All right. That's the safest way, I suppose. What I'm getting at is that if there aren't any troops over there, it wouldn't take more than a couple of us to escort His Grace safely to Kyrelos, while the rest of us go on to Lake Rundera.
If things are quiet, we don't all have to ride to the Holy City.
He's got a good point, Sparhawk, Carlton agreed.
I'll think about it, Sparhawk said. Let's go on across and have a look around before we make any decisions.
They remounted and splashed on across the shallow ford. There was a thicket on the far side.
It's going to get dark soon, Sparhawk, Keurig said, and we're going to have to make camp. Why don't we hole up in that thicket for the night? Once it gets completely dark, we can come out and look for campfires. No group of soldiers is going to set up for the night without building fires, and we'll be able to see them. That would be a lot easier and faster than riding up and down the river all day tomorrow trying to flush them out.
Good idea. Let's do it that way, then.
They made camp for the night in the center of the thicket and built only a small cook fire. By the time they had finished eating, night had fallen over Lammerkand. Sparhawk rose to his feet.
All right, he said. Let's go have a look. Sophronia, you and the children and His Grace stay here out of sight.
He led the way out of the thicket. Once they were clear of the trees, he and his companions fanned out, all of them peering intently into the night. The clouds obscured the moon and stars and made the darkness almost total. Sparhawk moved around the thicket. On the far side, he bumped into Carlton.
It's darker than the inside of your boots out here, Carlton said.
Did you see anything?
Not a glimmer.
There's a hill on the back side of these trees, though. Keurig's going up to the top to look around.
Good. I'll trust Keurig's eyes any time.
Me too.
Why don't you get him knighted, Sparhawk? When you get right down to it, he's better than any of us.
Aslade would kill me. She's not set up to be the wife of a knight.
Carlton laughed as they moved on, straining their eyes into the blackness.
Sparhawk!
Keurig's voice came from not far away.
Over there.
The squire joined them.
That's a fairly high hill, he puffed. The only light I saw was coming from a village a mile or so to the south.
You're sure it wasn't a campfire?
Carlton asked him.
Campfires make a different kind of light from lamps shining through a dozen windows, Carlton.
That's true, I suppose.
I guess that's it, then, Sparhawk said.
He raised his fingers to his lips and whistled.
a signal for the others to return to the camp.
"What do you think?" Carlton asked as they pushed their way through the stiffly rustling brush toward the center of the thicket, where the dim light of their banked cook fire was scarcely more than a faint red glow in the darkness.
"Let's ask His Grace," Sparhawk replied. "It's his neck we'll be risking."
They entered the brush-clogged encampment, and Sparhawk pushed back the hood of his cloak.
"We have a decision to make, Your Grace," he told the Patriarch. "The area appears to be deserted. Sir Tinian has suggested that two of us could escort you to Kyrolos in as much safety as the whole group. Our search for Belion must not be delayed if we're to keep Annius off the Archprelate's throne. The choice is up to you, though."
"I can go on to Kyrolos alone, Sir Sparhawk. My brother is overly concerned about my well-being. My cassock alone will protect me."
"I'd rather not gamble on that, Your Grace. You'll recall that I mentioned that something was pursuing us?"
"Yes, I believe you called it a seeker."
"Exactly. The creature is ill now because of the fumes Sophronia created. But there's no way to be positive of how long its illness will last. It wouldn't look upon you as an enemy, though. If it should attack, run away. It's unlikely that it would follow you. I think that under the circumstances, though, Tinian's right. Two of us will be enough to ensure your safety."
"As you see fit, my son."
The others had entered the camp during the conversation, and Tinian volunteered immediately.
"No."
Sophronia rejected that idea. "You're the one most skilled at necromancy. We're going to need you as soon as we reach Lake Rondera."
"I'll go," Bavia said. "I have a fast horse and can catch up with you at the lake."
"I'll go with him," Curic offered. "If you run into more trouble, Sparhawk, you'll need knights with you."
"There's not that much difference between you and a knight, Curic."
"I don't wear armor, Sparhawk," the squire pointed out. "The spectacle of church knights charging with lances makes people start thinking about their own mortality. It's a good way to avoid serious fighting."
"He's right, Sparhawk," Carlton said. "And if we run into more Zaymoks and church soldiers, you're going to need men wearing steel around you."
"All right," Sparhawk agreed. He turned to Ortsel. "I want to apologize for having offended Your Grace," he said. "I don't really see that we had much choice, though. If we'd all been forced to stay penned up in your brother's castle, both of our missions would have failed, and the church could not afford that."
"I still do not entirely approve, Sir Sparhawk, but your argument is most cogent. No apology is necessary."
"Thank you, Your Grace," Sparhawk said. "Try to get some sleep. You'll be a long time in the saddle tomorrow, I think."
He stepped away from the fire and rummaged through one of the packs until he found his map. Then he motioned to Bavier and Curic.
"Ride due west tomorrow," he told them. "Try to get back across the border into Pelosia before dark. Then go south to Kyrolos on that side of the line. I don't think even the most rabid Lamarck soldier will violate that boundary and risk a confrontation with Pelosian border patrols."
"Sound reasoning," Bavier approved.
"When you get to Kyrolos, drop Ortsel off at the Basilica. Then go see Dolmant. Tell him what's been going on here, and ask him to pass the word on to Vanion and the other preceptors. Urge them very strongly to resist the idea of sending the church knights out here into the hinterlands to put out the brush fires Martell's been starting. We're going to need the four orders in Kyrolos if Archprelate Clavonus dies, and luring them out of the holy city's what's been behind all of Martell's scheming."
"We will, Sparhawk," Bavia promised.
"Make the trip as quickly. His Grace appears to be fairly robust, so a little hard riding won't hurt him. The quicker you get across the border into Pelosia, the better. Waste any time, but be careful."
"You can count on that, Sparhawk," Curic assured him.
"We'll rejoin you at Lake Rondera as soon as we can," Bavier declared.
"Have you got enough money?" Sparhawk asked his squire.
"I can get by."
Then Curic grinned, his teeth flashing light.
"Besides, Dolmant and I are old friends. He's always good for a loan."
Sparhawk laughed.
"Get to bed, you two," he said. "I want you and Ortsel on your way to Pelosia at first light in the morning."
They arose before dawn and sent Bavier and Curic off to the west with the Patriarch of Kadok riding between them. Sparhawk consulted his map again by the light of their cookfire.
"We'll go back across this ford again," he told the others.
There's a larger channel east of here, so we'll probably need to find a bridge. Let's go north. I'd rather not run across any of Count Jerick's patrols. They splashed across the ford after breakfast and angled away from it as a mist indicated that somewhere behind the dreary cloud cover the sun had risen. Ian fell in beside Sparhawk. I don't want to sound disrespectful, he said, but I rather hope that the election doesn't fall to Ortsel. I think the Church and the Four Orders would be in for a bad time if he ascends the throne. He's a good man. Granted, but he's very rigid. An arch-prelate needs to be flexible. Times are changing, Sparhawk, and the Church needs to change with them. I don't think the notion of change would appeal to Ortsel very much. That's in the hands of the hierocracy, though. And I definitely prefer Ortsel to Annius. That's gone. About mid-morning, they overtook the clattering wagon of a shabby-looking itinerant tinker, who was also traveling northward. What cheer, neighbor? Sparhawk asked him.
Scant cheer, Sir Knight, the tinker replied glumly. These wars are bad for business. Nobody worries about a leaky pot when his house is under siege.
That's probably very true. Tell me, do you know of a bridge or a ford hereabouts where we can get across that river ahead?
There's a toll bridge a couple of leagues north, the tinker advised. Where are you bound, Sir Knight?
Lake Rondera. The tinker's eyes brightened.
To search for the treasure? He asked.
What treasure?
Everybody in Lemmerkand knows that there's a vast treasure buried somewhere on the old battlefield at the lake. People have been digging there for 500 years. About all they turn up is rusty swords and skeletons, though.
How did people find out about it? Sparhawk asked him, sounding casual.
It was the oddest thing. The way I understand it, not too long after the battle, people started seeing Styrix digging there. Now that doesn't really make any sense, does it? What I mean is that everybody knows that Styrix don't pay very much attention to money, and Styrix menfolk are very reluctant to pick up shovels. That sort of tool doesn't seem to fit their hands for some reason. At any rate, or so the story goes, people began to wonder just exactly what it was the Styrix were looking for. That's when the rumors started about the treasure. That ground's been plowed and sifted over 100 times or more. Nobody's sure what they're looking for, but everybody in Lemmerkand goes there once or twice in his lifetime.
Maybe the Styrix know what's buried there.
Maybe so, but no one can talk to them. They run away any time somebody gets near them.
Peculiar. Well, thank you for the information, neighbor. Have a nice day. They rode on, leaving the tinker's clanking wagon behind. That's gloomy, Colton said. Somebody got there with a shovel before we did.
A lot of shovels, Tinian amended.
He's right about one thing, though, Sparhawk said. I've never known a Styrix to be interested enough in money to go out of his way for it. I think we'd better find a Styrix village and ask a few questions. Something's going on at Lake Rondera that we don't know about. And I don't like surprises.
Chapter 7. The toll bridge was narrow and in some disrepair. A shabby hut stood at its near end with several dirty, hungry-looking children sitting listlessly in front of it. The bridge tender wore a ragged smock and his unshaven face was gaunt and hopeless. His eyes clouded with disappointment when he saw the armor of the knights.
No charge, he sighed.
You'll never make a living that way, friend, Colton told him.
It's a local regulation, my lord, the bridge tender said unhappily. No charge is made to church people.
Do very many people cross here? Tinian asked him.
No more than a few a week, the fellow replied. Hardly enough to make it possible for me to pay my taxes. My children haven't had a decent meal in months.
Are there any Styrix villages hereabouts? Sparhawk asked him.
I believe there's one on the other side of the river, Sir Knight, in that cedar forest over there.
Thank you, neighbor, Sparhawk said, pouring some coins into the startled fellow's hand.
I can't charge you to cross, my lord, the man objected.
The money's not for crossing, neighbor. It's for the information.
Sparhawk nudged Farron and started across the bridge. As Talon passed the bridge tender, he leaned over and handed him something.
Get your children something to eat, he said.
"Thank you, young master," the man said, tears of gratitude standing in his eyes.
"What did you give him?" Sparhawk asked.
"The money I stole from that sharp-eyed fellow back at the ford," Talon replied.
"That was very generous of you."
The boy shrugged. "I can always steal more. Besides, he and his children need it more than I do. I've been hungry a few times myself, and I know how it feels."
Colton leaned forward in his saddle.
"You know, there might be some hope for this boy after all, Sparhawk," he said quietly.
"It could be a little early to say for sure. At least it's a start." The damp forest on the far side of the river was composed of mossy old cedars with low swooping green boughs, and the trail leading into it was poorly marked.
"Well," Sparhawk said to Sophronia. "They're here," she told him. "They're watching us."
"They'll hide when we approach their village, won't they?"
"Probably. Styrix have little reason to trust armed Alines. I should be able to persuade at least some of them to come out, though." Like all Styrix villages, the place was rude. The thatch-roofed huts were scattered haphazardly in a clearing, and there was no street of any kind. As Sophronia had predicted, there was no one about. The small woman leaned over and spoke briefly to Flute in that Styrix dialect Sparhawk did not understand. The little girl nodded, lifted her pipes, and began to play. At first, nothing happened.
"I think I just saw one of them back in the trees," Colton said after a few moments.
"Timid, aren't they?" Talon said.
"They have reason to be," Sparhawk told him. "Alines don't treat Styrix very well."
Flute continued to play. After a time, a white-bearded man in a smock made of unbleached homespun emerged hesitantly from the forest. He put his hands together in front of his chest and bowed respectfully to Sophronia, speaking to her in Styrix. Then he looked at Flute, and his eyes widened. He bowed again, and she gave him an impish little smile. "Aged one," Sophronia said to him, "do you perchance speak the language of the Alines?"
"I have a passing familiarity with it, my sister," he replied.
"Good. These knights have a few questions, and then we'll leave your village and trouble you no more."
"I will answer as best I can."
"Some time back," Sparhawk began, "we chanced upon a tinker who told us something a bit disquieting. He said that Styrix have been digging in the battlefield at Lake Rondera for centuries, searching for a treasure. That doesn't seem like the sort of thing Styrix would do."
"It is not, my lord," the old man said flatly. "We have no need of treasure, and we would most certainly not violate the graves of those who sleep there."
"I thought that might be the case. Have you any idea of who those Styrix might be?"
"They are not of our kindred, Sir Knight, and they serve a god whom we despise."
"Azash," Sparhawk guessed. The old man blanched slightly.
"I will not speak his name aloud, Sir Knight, but you have hit upon my meaning."
"Then the men digging at the lake are Zamox?"
The old man nodded.
"We have known of their presence there for centuries. We do not go near them, for they are unclean."
"I think we'd all agree to that," Tinian said. "Have you got any idea of what they're looking for?"
"Some ancient talisman that Otha craves for his god."
"The tinker we spoke with said that most people around here believe there's a vast treasure there somewhere."
The old man smiled.
"Alines tend to exaggerate things," he said. "They cannot believe that the Zamox would devote so much effort to the finding of one single thing, although the thing they seek is of greater worth than all the treasure in the world."
"That answers that question, doesn't it?" Colton noted.
"Alines have an indiscriminate lust for gold and precious gems," the old Styrix went on, "and so it's entirely possible that they don't even know what they're looking for. They expect huge chests of treasure, but there are no such chests to be found on that field. It's not impossible that some one of them might already have found the object and cast it aside, not knowing its worth."
"No, aged master," Sophronia disagreed.
The talisman of which you speak has not yet been found. Its uncovering would ring like a giant bell through all the world.
It may be as you say, my sister. Do you and your companions also journey to the lake in search of the talisman?
Such is our intent, she replied, and our quest is of some urgency. If nothing else, we must deny possession of the talisman to Otha's god.
I shall pray to my god for your success, then.
The old Styrek looked back at Sparhawk.
How fares it with the head of the Aline Church?
He asked carefully.
The arch-prelate is very old, Sparhawk told him truthfully, and his health is failing.
The old man sighed.
It is as I feared, he said. Although I am sure he would not accept the good wishes of a Styrek, I nonetheless also pray to my god that he will live for many more years.
Amen to that, Ulith said.
The white-bearded Styrek hesitated.
Rumor states that the primate of a place called Simera is most likely to become the head of your church,
he said cautiously.
That could be a bit exaggerated, Sparhawk told him. There are many in the church who oppose the ambitions of Primate Anius. A part of our purpose is to thwart him as well.
Then I shall pray for you doubly, Sir Knight. Should Anius reach the throne in Kyrillos, it will be a disaster for Styricum.
And for just about everybody else as well, Ulith grunted.
It will be far more deadly for Styrix, Sir Knight. The feelings of Anius of Simera about our race are widely known. The authority of the Aline Church has kept the hatred of the Aline Commons in check. But should Anius succeed, he will probably remove that restraint, and I fear Styricum will be doomed.
We will do all we can to prevent his reaching the throne, Sparhawk promised.
The old Styrek bowed.
May the hands of the younger gods of Styricum protect you, my friends.
He bowed again to Sophrenia, and then to Flute. Let's move on, Sophrenia said. We're keeping the other villagers away from their homes. They rode out of the village and back into the forest.
So, the people digging up the battlefield are Zamoks, Tinian mused.
They're creeping all over Western Aeosia, aren't they?
We have known that it's all part of Otha's plan for generations, Sophrenia said. Most Alenes cannot tell the difference between Western Styrix and Zamoks. Otha does not want any kind of alliance or reconciliation between Western Styrix and Alenes. A few well-placed atrocities have kept the prejudices of the Alene common people inflamed, and the stories of such incidents grow with every telling. This has been the source of centuries of general oppression and random massacres.
Why does the possibility of an alliance worry Otha so much? Calton sounded puzzled. There aren't enough Styrix in the West to pose that much of a threat, and since they won't touch steel weapons, they wouldn't be much use if war breaks out again, would they?
The Styrix would fight with magic, not steel, Calton, Sparhawk told him. And Styrix magicians know a lot more about it than the church knights.
The fact that the Zamoks are at Lake Rondera is promising, though, Tinian said.
How so? Calton asked. If they're still digging, it means they haven't found Beliom yet. It also sort of hints at the fact that we're going to the right place.
I'm not so sure, Ulith disagreed.
If they've been looking for Beliom for the last 500 years and still haven't found it, maybe Lake Rondera's not the right place.
Why haven't the Zamoks tried necromancy the way we're going to? Calton asked.
The Lasian spirits would not respond to a Zamok necromancer, Ulith replied. They'll probably talk to me, but not to anybody else.
It's a good thing you're along, then, Ulith, Tinian said. I'd hate to go to all the trouble of raising ghosts and then find out that they won't talk to me.
If you raise them, I'll talk with them.
You didn't ask him about the Seeker, Sparhawk said to Sophrenia.
There was no need. It would only have frightened him. Besides, if those villagers had known the Seeker was in this part of the world, the village would have been abandoned.
Maybe we should have warned him.
No, Sparhawk. Life is hard enough for those people without turning them into vagabonds. The Seeker is looking for us. The villagers are in no danger.
It was late afternoon by the time they reached the edge of the woods. They halted there and peered out over seemingly deserted fields.
Let's camp back here among the trees, Sparhawk said. That's awfully open ground out there. I'd rather not have anyone see our fires if I can avoid it.
They rode back among the trees a ways and set up camp for the night. Calton walked out to the edge of the wood to keep watch. Shortly after dark, he returned.
"You'd better hide that fire a little better," he told Bayrett. "You can see it from the edge of the trees."
"Right away, Sir Calton," the young novice replied. He took a spade and banked more earth around their small cook fire.
"We're not the only ones around here, Sparhawk,"
the big blonde Pandion said seriously.
"There are a couple of fires about a mile out there in those fields."
"Let's go have a look," Sparhawk said to Tinian and Euleth.
"We'll need to pinpoint the location so we can slip around them in the morning. Even if the Seeker won't be a problem for several more days, there are still other people trying to keep us away from the lake. Coming, Calton?"
"Go ahead," his friend said. "I haven't eaten yet. We might need you to point the fires out to us."
"You can't miss them," Calton said, filling his wooden bowl. "Whoever built them wants lots of light."
"He's very attached to his stomach, isn't he?" Tinian said as the three knights walked toward the edge of the wood.
"He eats a great deal," Sparhawk admitted. "But he's a big man, so it takes a lot of food to keep him going."
The fires far out in the open fields were clearly visible. Sparhawk carefully noted the locations.
"We'll swing north, I think," he said quietly to the others. "Probably we'll want to stay in the woods until we get well past those camps out there."
"Peculiar," Euleth said.
"What is?" Tinian asked.
"Those camps aren't very far apart. If the men out there know each other, why didn't they just make one camp?"
"Maybe they don't like each other."
"Why did they camp so close together, then?"
Tinian shrugged. "Who knows why Lamorks do anything?"
"There's nothing we can do about them tonight," Sparhawk said. "Let's go back."
Sparhawk awoke just before dawn. When he went to rouse the others, he found that Tinian, Bayrett, and Talon were missing. Tinian's absence was easily explained. He was on watch at the edge of the woods. The novice and the boy, however, had no business being out of their beds. Sparhawk swore and went to wake Sophronia.
"Bayrett and Talon have gone off somewhere," he told her.
She looked around at the darkness pressing in on their well-hidden camp. "We'll have to wait until it gets light," she said. "If they're not back by then, we'll have to go look for them. Stir up the fire, Sparhawk, and put my tea kettle near the flame." The sky to the east was growing lighter when Bayrett and Talon returned to camp. They both looked excited, and their eyes were very bright.
"Just where have you two been?" Sparhawk demanded angrily.
"Satisfying a curiosity," Talon replied. "We went to pay a visit on our neighbors."
"Can you translate that for me, Bayrett?"
"We crept across the fields to have a look at the people around those campfires out there, Sir Sparhawk."
"Without asking me first?"
"You were asleep," Talon explained quickly. "We didn't want to wake you."
"They're Styrix, Sir Sparhawk," Bayrett said seriously.
"At least some of them are. There's a fair scattering of Lamorck peasants among them, though. The men around the other fire are all church soldiers."
"Could you tell if the ones you saw were Western Styrix or Zamox?"
"I can't tell one kind of Styrix from another. But the ones out there have swords and spears." Bayrett frowned. "This might have been my imagination. But all the men out there are sort of numb-looking. Do you remember how blank the faces of that group of ambushers back in Alania were?"
"Yes."
"The people out there look more or less the same. And they're not talking to each other, or even sleeping. And they haven't posted any sentries."
"Well, Sophronia," Sparhawk said, "could the Seeker have recovered more quickly than you thought it would?"
"No," she replied, frowning. "It could have set those men in our path before it went on to Simera, however. They'd follow any instructions it might have given them, but they wouldn't be able to respond to any new situations without its presence."
"They'd recognize us, though, wouldn't they?"
"Yes. The Seeker would have implanted that in their minds."
"And they'd attack us if they saw us."
"Inevitably."
"Then I think we'd better move on," he said. "Those people out there are just a little too close to make me feel entirely comfortable. I don't like riding through strange country before it's fully light, but under the circumstances..."
Then he turned sternly to Bayrett.
"I appreciate the information you've brought us, Bayrett. But you shouldn't have gone off without telling me first, and you most definitely should not have taken Talon along.
You and I are paid to take certain risks, but you had absolutely no right to endanger him.
He didn't know I was tagging along behind him, Sparhawk, Talon said glibly. I saw him get up, and I was curious about what he was doing, so I sneaked after him. He didn't even know I was there until we were almost to those campfires.
That's not precisely true, Sir Sparhawk, Barrett disagreed with a pained look. Talon woke me and suggested that the two of us should go have a look at those men out there. It seemed like a very good idea at the time. I'm sorry, I didn't even think of the fact that I was putting him in danger.
Talon looked at the novice with some disgust.
Now why did you do that?
He asked.
I was telling them a perfectly good lie. I could have kept you out of trouble.
I've taken an oath to tell the truth, Talon.
Well, I haven't. All you had to do was keep your mouth shut. Sparhawk won't hit me because I'm too little. He might decide to thrash you, though.
I love these little arguments about comparative morality before breakfast, Colton said.
Speaking of which,
he looked meaningfully toward the fire.
It's your turn, Euliff told him.
What?
It's your turn to do the cooking.
It surely can't be my turn again already.
Euliff nodded.
I've been keeping track.
Colton put on a pious expression.
Sparhawk's probably right, though. We really should move on. We can have something to eat later.
They broke camp quietly and saddled their horses. Tinian came back from the edge of the woods where he had been keeping watch.
They're breaking up into small parties, he reported. I think they're going to scour the countryside.
We'll want to keep to the woods then, Sparhawk said. Let's ride.
They moved cautiously, staying well back from the edge of the trees. Tinian rode out to the fringe of the forest from time to time to scout out the movements of the numb-faced men out in the open fields.
They seem to be ignoring these woods entirely, he said after one such foray.
They're unable to think independently, Sophrenia explained.
No matter, Colton said. They're between us and the lake, and as long as they're patrolling those fields out there, we can't get through. We're going to run out of woods eventually, and then we'll be at a standstill.
Just exactly which ones are patrolling this section? Sparhawk asked Tinian.
Church soldiers. They're riding in groups.
How many in each group?
About a dozen.
Are the groups staying in sight of each other?
They're spreading out more and more.
Good.
Sparhawk's face was bleak.
Go keep an eye on them and let me know when they're far enough apart so they can't see each other.
All right. Sparhawk dismounted and tied Farron's reins to a sapling. What have you got in your mind, Sparhawk? Sophrenia asked suspiciously as Bayred helped her and flew down from her white palfrey.
We know that the Seeker was probably sent by Otha, which means Azash.
Yes?
Azash knows that Belion's about to emerge again, right?
Yes?
The Seeker's primary task is to kill us. But if it fails to do that, wouldn't it settle for keeping us away from Lake Randera?
Eileen Logic again, she said disgustedly. You're transparent, Sparhawk. I can see where you're leading with this.
Even though their minds are blank, the church soldiers would still be able to pass information to each other, wouldn't they?
Yes,
she said it grudgingly. Then we don't have any choice in the matter. If any of them see us, we'll have them all right behind us within an hour.
I don't quite follow, Talon said, looking puzzled.
He's going to kill all the men in one of those patrols, Sophrenia said.
To the last man, Sparhawk said grimly, and just as soon as the others are all out of sight.
They can't even run away, you know.
Good, then I won't have to chase them.
You're plotting deliberate murder, Sparhawk.
That's not precisely accurate, Sophrenia. They'll attack as soon as they see us. What we'll be doing is defending ourselves.
Sophistry, she snapped and stalked away, muttering to herself.
I didn't even think she knew what that word means, Colton said.
Do you know how to use a lance? Sparhawk asked Euliff.
I've been trained with it, the Thalesian replied. I much prefer my axe, though.
With a lance, you don't have to get in quite so close. Let's not take too many chances.
We should be able to put a fair number of them down with our lances, and then we can finish up with our swords and axes.
There are only five of us, you know, Colton said, counting Bayret.
So?
I just thought I'd mention it.
Sifrania came back, her face pale.
"Then you're absolutely set on this?" she demanded of Sparhawk.
"We have to get to the lake. Can you think of any alternatives?"
"No. As a matter of fact, I can't." Her tone was sarcastic. "Your impeccable Aline logic has completely disarmed me."
"I've been meaning to ask you something, little mother," Colton said, obviously trying to head off an argument by changing the subject. "Exactly what does this seeker thing look like? It seems to go to a great deal of trouble to keep itself hidden."
"It's hideous," she shuddered. "I've never seen one, but the Styric magician who taught me how to counter it described it to me. Its body is segmented, very pale and very thin. At this stage, its outer skin has not yet completely hardened, and it oozes out a kind of ichor from between its segments to protect the skin from contact with the air. It has crab-like claws, and its face is horrible beyond belief."
"Ichor? What's that?"
"Slime," she replied shortly. "It's in its larval stage, sort of like a caterpillar or a worm, although not quite. When it reaches adulthood, its body hardens and darkens, and its wings emerge. Not even a Zash can control an adult. All they're concerned with at that stage is reproducing. Set a pair of adults loose and they'd turn the entire world into a hive and feed every living creature on Earth to their young. A Zash keeps a pair for breeding purposes in a place from which they can't escape. When one of the larvae he uses as seekers approaches adulthood, he has it killed."
"Working for a Zash has its risks, doesn't it? But I've never seen any kind of insect that looks like that."
"Normal rules don't apply to the creatures who serve a Zash." She looked at Sparhawk, her expression agonized. "Do we really have to do this?" she asked him.
"I'm afraid we do," he replied. "There's no other way." They sat on the damp forest loam, waiting for Tinian to return. Colton went to one of the pack saddles and cut large slabs from a cheese and a loaf of bread with his dagger. "This takes care of my turn at cooking, right?" he said to Euleth. Euleth grunted. "I'll think about that."
The sky overhead was still cloudy, and birds drowsed among the dark green cedar boughs that filled the wood with their fragrance. Once a deer approached them, stepping delicately along a forest trail. One of the horses snorted, and the deer bounded away, his white tail flashing and his velvet-covered antlers flaring above his head. It was peaceful here, but Sparhawk pushed that peace from his mind, steeling himself for the task ahead. Tinian returned. "There's one group of soldiers sort of stationed a few hundred yards north of us," he reported quietly. "All the others are out of sight."
"Good," Sparhawk said, rising to his feet. "We might as well get started. Sifrania, you stay here with Talon and Flute."
"What's the plan?" Tinian asked.
"No plan," Sparhawk replied. "We're just going to ride out there and eliminate that patrol. Then we'll ride on to Lake Rondera."
"It has a certain direct charm," Tinian agreed.
"Remember, all of you," Sparhawk went on. "They won't react to wounds the way normal people would. Make sure of them so they won't come at you from behind when you move on to the next one. Let's go."
The fight was short and brutal. As soon as Sparhawk and the others burst from the wood in a thundering charge, the blank-faced church soldiers drove their horses across the grassy field toward them, their swords aloft. When the two parties were perhaps 50 paces apart, Sparhawk, Colton, Tinian, and Euleth lowered their lances and set themselves. The shock of the impact was terrific. The soldier Sparhawk struck was picked out of his saddle by the lance that drove through his chest and emerged from his back. Sparhawk reined Farron in sharply to avoid breaking his lance. He pulled it free of the body and then charged on. His lance broke off in the body of another soldier. He discarded it and drew his sword. He lopped an arm off a third soldier, then drove the point of his sword through the man's throat. Euleth had broken his lance on the first soldier he attacked, but then he had driven the broken end into the body of another. Then the big Genidian had reverted to his axe. He smoothly brained yet another soldier. Tinian had driven his lance through another soldier's belly and had finished him with his sword and moved on to another. Colton's lance had shattered against a soldier's shield, and he was being hard-pressed by two others until Bayret rode in and chopped the top off one of their heads with his axe.
Colton finished the other with a broad stroke. The remaining soldiers were milling around in confusion, their venom-numbed minds unable to react quickly enough to the assault by the Knights of the Church. Sparhawk and his companions crushed them together in a tangle and methodically butchered them. Colton swung down from his saddle and walked among the fallen soldiers lying in huddled heaps on the bloody grass. Sparhawk turned his head away as his friend systematically ran his sword into each body. "Just wanted to be sure," Colton said, sheathing his sword and remounting. "None of them are going to do any talking now." "Bayret," Sparhawk said, "go get Sophronia and the children. We'll keep watch here. Oh, one other thing. You'd better cut us some new lances as well. The ones we had seemed to be all used up."
"Yes, Sir Sparhawk," the novice said, and rode back toward the woods.
Sparhawk looked around and saw a brush-choked draw not far away. "Let's hide these," he said, looking at the bodies. "We don't want to make it obvious that we've come this way." "Did their horses all run off?" Colton asked, looking around. "Yes," Ulith replied. "Horses do that when there's fighting." They dragged the mutilated corpses to the draw and dumped them into the brush. By the time they had finished, Bayret was returning with Sophronia, Talon, and Flute. He carried the new lances across his saddle. Sophronia kept her eyes averted from the blood-stained grass where the fight had taken place. It took but a few minutes to affix the steel points to the lances, and then they all remounted.
"Now I'm really hungry," Colton said as they set out at a gallop.
"How can you?" Sophronia demanded in a tone of revulsion.
"What did I say?"
Colton asked Sparhawk.
"Never mind."
The next several days passed without incident, although Sparhawk and the others kept wary eyes to the rear as they galloped on. They took shelter each night in places of concealment and built small, well-shielded fires. And then the cloudy skies finally fulfilled their promise. A steady drizzle began to fall as they pushed on toward the northeast.
"Wonderful," Colton said sardonically, looking up at the soggy sky.
"Just pray that it rains harder," Sophronia told him. "The Seeker should be moving about again by now, but it won't be able to follow our scent if it's been washed out by rain."
"I suppose I hadn't thought of that," he admitted.
Sparhawk periodically dismounted to cut a stick from a particular kind of low-lying bush and to lay it carefully on the ground, pointing in the direction they were going.
"Why do you keep doing that?"
Tinian asked him finally, pulling his dripping blue cloak tighter about him.
"To let Keurig know which way we've gone," Sparhawk replied, remounting.
"Very clever. But how will he know which bush to look behind?"
"It's always the same kind of bush. Keurig and I worked that out a long time ago."
The sky continued to weep. It was a depressing kind of rain that soaked into everything. Campfires were difficult to get started and tended to go out without much advance notice. Occasionally they passed Lamarck villages and now and then an isolated farmstead. The people for the most part were staying in out of the rain, and the cattle grazing in the fields were wet and dispirited looking. They were not too far from the lake when Bavier and Keurig finally caught up with them on a blustery afternoon when the steady rain was blowing almost horizontally to the ground. "We delivered Ortsel to the Basilica," Bavier reported, wiping his dripping face. "Then we went to Dolman's house and told him about what was happening here in Lamarkand. He agrees that the upheaval is probably designed to pull the church knights out of Kyrillos. He'll do what he can to block that."
"Good," Sparhawk said. "I like the notion of all Martell's efforts being wasted. Did you have any problems along the way?"
"Nothing serious," Bavier said. "The roads are all being patrolled, though, and Kyrillos is crawling with soldiers."
"And all the soldiers are loyal to Aeneas, I suppose," Colton said sourly.
"There are other candidates for the archprelacy, Colton," Tinian pointed out. "If Aeneas is bringing his troops into Kyrillos, it stands to reason that the others would bring in theirs as well."
"We certainly don't want open fighting in the streets of the Holy City," Sparhawk said. "How's Archprelate Clavonus?" he asked Bavier.
"He's fading fast, I'm afraid. The Hierocracy can't even hide his condition from the common people anymore."
"That makes what we're doing all the more urgent," Colton said. "If Clavonus dies, Aeneas will start to move,
and at that point he won't need the Alanian treasury anymore. Let's press on, then, Sparhawk said. It's still a day or so to the lake.
Sparhawk, Keurig said critically, you've let your armor get rusty.
Really? Sparhawk pulled back his sodden black cloak and looked at his red-tinged shoulder plates with some surprise. Couldn't you find the oil bottle, my lord?
I had my mind on other things.
Obviously.
I'm sorry. I'll deal with it.
You wouldn't know how.
Don't fool with the armor, Sparhawk. I'll tend to it.
Sparhawk looked around at his companions.
If anybody makes an issue of this, there's going to be a fight, he said ominously.
We would sooner die than offend you, my lord Sparhawk, Xavier promised with an absolutely straight face.
I appreciate that, Sparhawk told him, and then rode resolutely off into the driving rain, his rusty armor creaking.
Chapter 8 The ancient battlefield at Lake Rondera in north-central Lamarkan was even more desolate than they had been led to believe. It was a vast wasteland of turned-over earth with mounds of dirt heaped up everywhere. There were huge holes and trenches in the ground filled with muddy water, and the steady rain had turned the vast field into a quagmire. Colton sat his horse beside Sparhawk, looking helplessly out at the muddy field that seemed to stretch off to the horizon.
Where do we start? He asked,
sounding baffled at the enormity of the task before them. Sparhawk remembered something.
Xavier, he called.
The Arshan rode forward.
Yes, Sparhawk.
You said that you'd made a study of military history.
Yes.
Since this was the biggest battle that's ever been fought, you probably devoted some time to it, didn't you?
Of course.
Do you think you might be able to locate the general area where the Thalesians were fighting?
Give me a few moments to orient myself.
Xavier rode slowly out into the soggy field, looking around intently for some landmark.
There,
he said finally, pointing toward a nearby hill that was half obscured in the misty drizzle.
That's where the troops of the King of Arsham made their stand against the hordes of Otha and their supernatural allies. They were hard-pressed, but they held on until the Knights of the Church reached this field.
He squinted thoughtfully into the rain.
If my memory serves me correctly, the army of King Sarek of Thalesia swept down around the east side of the lake in a flanking maneuver. They would have fought much farther to the east.
At least that narrows things down a little bit, Colton said.
Would the Janidian knights have been with Sarek's army?
Xavier shook his head.
All the church knights had been engaged in the campaign in Rendor. When word reached them of Otha's invasion, they sailed across the inner sea to Camoria, and then made a forced march to get here. They arrived on the field from the south.
Sparhawk, Talon said quietly, over there. Some people are trying to hide behind that big mound of dirt, the one with that tree stump halfway up the side.
Sparhawk carefully avoided turning.
Could you get any kind of a look at them?
I couldn't tell what kind of people they are, the boy replied. They're all covered with mud.
Did they have any kind of weapons?
Shovels, mostly. I think a couple of them had crossbows.
Lamarks, then, Colton said. Nobody else uses that weapon.
Keurig, Sparhawk said to his squire. What's the effective range of a crossbow?
200 paces with any kind of accuracy. After that, you sort of have to rely on luck.
Sparhawk looked around, trying to appear casual. The heaped-up mound of dirt was perhaps 50 yards away.
We'll want to go on that way, he said in a voice loud enough to be heard by the lurking treasure-seekers.
He raised one steel-gauntleted hand and pointed east.
How many are there, Talon? He asked quietly.
I saw 8 or 10. There could be more.
Keep your eyes on them, but don't be too obvious about it. If any of them starts to raise his crossbow, warn us.
Right. Sparhawk started out at a steady trot. Theron's hooves splashed up the semi-liquid mud.
Don't look back, he warned the others. Wouldn't a gallop be more appropriate about now? Colton asked in a strained voice.
Let's not let them know that we've seen them.
This is very hard on my nerves, Sparhawk, Colton muttered, shifting his shield. I've got this very uneasy feeling right between my shoulder blades.
So do I, Sparhawk admitted. Talon, are they doing anything?
Just watching us,
the boy replied.
I can see a head pop up every so often.
They trotted on, splashing through the mud.
We're almost clear, Tinian said tensely. The rain's settling down around that hill, Talon reported. I don't think they can see us now.
Good, Sparhawk said, letting out an explosive breath of relief. Let's slow down. It's obvious that we're not alone out here, and we don't want to blunder into anything.
Nervous, Ulith commented.
Wasn't it, though? Tinian agreed.
I don't know why you were worried, Ulith said, eyeing Tinian's massive Daeran armor, considering all the steel you've got wrapped around you.
At close range, a crossbow bolt will penetrate even this. Tinian rapped his fist on the front of his armor. It made a ringing sound, almost like a bell. Sparhawk, the next time you talk to the Hierocracy, why don't you suggest that they outlaw crossbows? I felt positively naked out there.
How do you carry all that armor? Carlton asked him.
Painfully, my friend, very painfully. The first time they strapped it on me, I collapsed. It took me an hour to get back on my feet.
Keep your eyes open, Sparhawk cautioned. A few Lamert treasure hunters are one thing, but men controlled by the Seeker are something else. If it had those men back there near the woods, it's certain to have some here as well.
They splashed on through the mud, looking about cautiously. Sparhawk consulted his map again, shielding it from the rain with his cloak.
The city of Rondera is up on the east shore of the lake, he said.
Bavier, did any of your books say anything about whether the Thalesians occupied it?
That portion of the battle is a bit obscure in the chronicles I've read, the white-cloaked knight replied.
About the only accounts of that part of the battle just say that the Zaymoks occupied Rondera fairly early in their campaign. Whether or not the Thalesians did anything about that, I simply don't know.
They wouldn't have, Ulith declared. Thalesians have never been very good at sieges. We don't have that kind of patience. King Sarek's army probably bypassed it.
This might be easier than I thought, Carlton said.
The only area we have to search is what lies between Rondera and the south end of the lake.
Don't get your hopes up too much, Carlton, Sparhawk told him. It's still a lot of ground.
He looked off into the drizzle toward the lake. The lake shore seems to be sand, and wet sand is better to ride on than mud.
He turned Farron and led the others toward the lake. The sandy beach that stretched off into the distance along the south shore of the lake did not seem to have been excavated in the same way the rest of the field had. Carlton looked around as they rode out onto the expanse of damp sand.
I wonder why they haven't been digging here, he said.
High water, Ulith replied cryptically.
I beg your pardon?
The water level rises in the winter, and it washes the sand back into any holes they might have dug.
Oh, that makes sense, I suppose.
They rode cautiously along the edge of the water for the next half hour.
How far do we have to go? Carlton asked Sparhawk. You're the one with the map.
10 leagues anyway, Sparhawk replied. This beach seems to be open enough to make a gallop safe.
He nudged Farron with his heels and led the way. The rain continued unabated, and the dimpled surface of the lake was the color of lead. They had ridden some miles along the water's edge when they saw another group of men digging somewhat furtively out in the sodden field.
Pelosians, Ulith disdainfully identified them.
How can you tell? Carlton asked him.
Those silly pointed hats.
Oh.
I think they fit the shape of their heads. They probably heard rumors about the treasure and came down from the north.
Do you want us to run them off, Sparhawk?
Let them dig. They're not bothering us, at least not as long as they stay where they are. Men who belong to the Seeker wouldn't be interested in treasure.
They rode on along the beach until late afternoon.
What do you say to making camp up there?
Kurek suggested, pointing to a large pile of driftwood just ahead.
I've got some dry wood in one of the packs, and we ought to be able to find more near the bottom of that pile.
Sparhawk looked up at the dripping clouds, gauging the time of day.
It's time to stop anyway, he agreed.
They reined in beside the driftwood, and Kurek built his fire. Bayret and Talon began pulling relatively dry sticks out from under the pile,
But after a while, Beirut went back to his horse for his battle axe.
What are you going to do with that?
Euleth asked him. I'm going to chop up some of those larger pieces with it, Sir Euleth.
No, you're not.
Beirut looked a bit startled.
That's not what it was made for. You'll dull the edge, and you might need that edge before long.
My axe is in that pack over there, Beirut, Kurek told the shame-faced novice. Use that. I don't plan to hit anybody with it. Kurek, Sifrania said from inside the tent Sparhawk and Calton had just erected for her and Flute, put up a cover near the fire and string a rope under it. She emerged from the tent wearing a styrix smock and carrying her dripping white robe in one hand and Flute's garment in the other. It's time to dry out some clothes. After the sun went down, a night breeze began to blow in off the lake, making the tents flap and tossing the flames of their fire. They ate a meager supper and then sought their beds. About midnight, Calton came back from where he had been standing watch. He shook Sparhawk awake.
It's your turn, he said quietly to avoid waking the others.
All right.
Sparhawk sat up yawning.
Did you find a good place?
That hill just behind the beach. Watch your step climbing it, though. They've been digging in the sides of it. Sparhawk began to put on his armor.
We're not alone here, Sparhawk, Calton said, removing his helmet and his dripping black cloak. I saw a half dozen fires a good ways out in that field.
More Pelosians and Lamarcks?
It's a little hard to say. A fire doesn't usually have any kind of identifying marks on it.
Don't tell Talon and Beirut. I don't want them creeping around in the dark anymore.
Get some sleep, Calton. Tomorrow might be a long day.
Sparhawk carefully climbed the pitted side of the hill and took up a position on top. He immediately saw the fires Calton had mentioned, but saw also that they were a long way off and posed little threat. They had been long on the road now, and a growing sense of impatient urgency gnawed at Sparhawk. Elana sat alone in the silent throne room back in Simera, with her life ticking away. A few more months and her heartbeat would falter, and then stop. Sparhawk pulled his mind away from that thought. As he usually did when that apprehension came over him, he deliberately set his mind on other matters and other memories. The rain was chill and damp and unpleasant, so he turned his thoughts to Rendor, where the blistering sun burned all trace of moisture from the air. He remembered the lines of black-veiled women gracefully going to the well at dawn before the sun made the streets of Jirok unbearable. He remembered Lelius, with a wry smile, and he wondered if the melodramatic scene in the street near the docks had earned her the kind of respect she so desperately needed. And then he remembered Martell. That night in Arasham's tent in Dabur had been a good one. To see his hated enemy filled with chagrin and frustration had been almost as satisfying as killing him might have been.
Some day, though, Martell, he muttered, you have a lot to pay for, and I think it's almost time for me to collect.
It was a good thought, and Sparhawk dwelt on it as he stood in the rain. He thought about it in some detail until it was time to rouse Euleth for his turn on watch. They broke camp at daybreak and rode on down the rain-swept beach. About mid-morning, Sifrania reined in her white palfrey with a warning hiss.
Zamox, she said sharply.
Where? Sparhawk asked.
I can't be sure. They're close, though, and their intentions are unfriendly.
How many?
It's very hard to tell, Sparhawk. At least a dozen, but probably fewer than a score.
Take the children and ride back to the edge of the water.
He looked at his companions.
Let's see if we can flush them out, he said. I don't want them following us.
The knights advanced across the muddy field at a walk, their lances lowered. Beirut and Kurek flanked them on either side. The Zamoks were hiding in a shallow trench less than 100 yards from the beach. When they saw the 7 Alines resolutely bearing down on them, they rose with their weapons in their hands. There were perhaps 15 of them, but the fact that they were on foot put them at a distinct disadvantage. They made no sound, uttered no war cries, and their eyes were empty.
The Seekers sent them, Sparhawk barked. Be careful.
As the knights approached,
The Zamoks shambled forward, and several even blindly hurled themselves on the lance points.
"Drop the lances," Sparhawk commanded. "They're too close."
He cast aside his lance and drew his sword. Again the men controlled by the Seeker charged in eerie silence and paid no attention to their fallen comrades. Although they had the advantage of numbers, they were really no match for the mounted knights, and their doom was sealed when Kurik and Beirut outflanked them and came at them from the rear. The fight lasted for perhaps 10 minutes, and then it was over.
"Is anybody hurt?" Sparhawk asked, looking around quickly.
"Several, I'd say," Colton replied, looking at the bodies lying in the mud.
"This is getting to be a little too easy, Sparhawk. They charge in almost asking to be killed."
"I'm always glad to oblige," Tinian said, wiping his sword with a Zamok smock.
"Let's drag them back to that trench they were hiding in," Sparhawk said. "Kurik, go back and get your spade. We'll cover them over."
"Hide the evidence, eh?" Colton said gaily.
"There may be others around," Sparhawk said. "Let's not announce that we've been here."
"Right, but I want to make sure of them before we start dragging. I'd rather not have one wake up when my hands are occupied with his ankles."
Colton dismounted and went through the grim business of making sure of them. Then they all fell to work. The slippery mud made dragging the inert bodies easier. Kurik stood at the edge of the trench, scooping mud over the corpses with his spade.
"Vavier," Tinian said, "are you really so attached to that Lochaber?"
"It's my weapon of choice," Vavier replied.
"Why do you ask?"
"It's a little inconvenient when the time comes to tidy up. When you lop off their heads like that, it means we have to make 2 trips with each one."
Tinian bent over and picked up 2 severed heads by the hair as if to emphasize his point.
"How droll," Vavier said dryly.
After they had dropped all the bits and pieces of the Zamok bodies and their weapons in the trench, and Kurik had covered them with mud, they rode back to the beach where Sophrania sat on her horse, carefully keeping Flute's face covered with the hem of her cloak and trying to keep her own eyes turned away.
"Have you finished?"
she asked as Sparhawk and the others approached.
"It's all over," he assured herself. "You can look now."
He frowned.
Colton just raised a point. He said that this was getting to be almost too easy. These people just charge in without thinking. It's as if they want to be killed.
"That's not really it, Sparhawk," she replied. "The Seeker has men to spare. It will throw away hundreds just to kill one of us, and hundreds more to kill the next one."
"That's depressing. If it has so many, why is it sending them out in such small groups?"
"They're scouting parties. Ants and bees do exactly the same thing. They send out small groups to find what the colony is looking for. The Seeker is still an insect, after all. And in spite of his ash, it still thinks like one."
"At least they're not reporting back," Colton said. "None of the ones we've met so far, anyway."
"They already have," she disagreed. "The Seeker knows when its forces have been diminished. It may not know precisely where we are, but it knows that we've been killing its soldiers. I think we'd better leave here. If there was one group out there, there are probably others as well. We don't want them converging on us."
Ulith was talking seriously to Beirut as they rode out at a trot. "Keep your axe under control at all times," he advised. "Don't ever make a swing so wide that you can't recover instantly."
"I think I see,"
Beirut replied seriously. "An axe can be just as delicate a weapon as a sword, if you know what you're doing," Ulith said. "Pay attention, boy. Your life might depend on this."
"I thought the whole idea was to hit somebody with it as hard as you can."
"There's no real need of that," Ulith replied. "Not if you keep it sharp. When you're cracking a walnut with a hammer, you hit it just hard enough to break the shell. You don't want to smash it into little bits. It's the same with an axe. If you hit somebody too hard with one, there's a fair chance that the blade's going to hang up in the body somewhere, and that leaves you at a definite disadvantage when you have to face your next opponent."
"I didn't know an axe was that complicated a weapon," Colton said quietly to Sparhawk.
"I think it's a part of the Thalesian religion," Sparhawk replied.
He looked at Beirut, whose face was rapt as he listened to Ulith's instruction. I hate to say this, but we've probably lost a good swordsman there. Beirut's very fond of that axe, and Ulith's encouraging him. Late in the day, the lake shore began to curve toward the northeast. Bavier looked around, getting his bearings.
I think we'd better stop here, Sparhawk, he advised. As closely as I can tell, this is approximately where the Thalesians came up against the Zamoks.
All right, Sparhawk agreed. I guess the rest is up to you, Tinian.
First thing in the morning, the Alcyone knight replied.
Why not now?
Calton asked him.
It's going to start getting dark soon, Tinian said, his face bleak. I don't raise ghosts at night.
Oh?
Just because I know how to do it doesn't mean that I like it.
I want lots of daylight around me when they start to appear. These men were killed in battle, so they won't be very pretty to look at. I'd rather not have any of them coming up to me in the dark.
Sparhawk and the other knights scouted the general area while Kurek, Beirut, and Talon set up camp. The rain was slacking slightly as they returned.
Anything?
Kurek asked, looking out from under the sheets of canvas he had erected at an angle over the fire.
There's some smoke a few miles off to the south, Calton replied, swinging down from his horse.
We didn't see anybody, though.
We'll still have to post a watch, Sparhawk said. If Bavier knows that this is the general area where the Thalesians were fighting, we can be fairly sure the Zamoks will, too. And the Seeker probably knows what we're looking for, so it's certain to have people in this area.
They were all unusually quiet that evening as they sat under Kurek's makeshift canvas cover that kept the rain from quenching their fire. This place had been their goal in the weeks since they had left Simara, and very soon they would find out if the trip had served any real purpose. Sparhawk in particular was anxious and worried. He definitely wanted to get on with it, but he respected Tinian's feeling in the matter.
Is the process very complicated? He asked the broad-shouldered Deiran.
Necromancy, I mean?
It's not your average spell, if that's what you mean, Tinian replied. The incantation's fairly long, and you have to draw diagrams on the ground to protect yourself. Sometimes the dead don't want to be awakened, and they can do some fairly nasty things to you if they're really upset.
How many of them do you plan to raise at a time? Calton asked him.
One, Tinian said very firmly. I don't want a whole brigade of them coming at me all at once. It might take a little longer, but it's a great deal safer.
You're the expert, I guess.
The morning dawned wet and dreary. The rain had returned during the night. The sodden earth had already received more water than it could hold, and rain-dimpled puddles stood everywhere.
A perfect day for raising the dead, Calton observed sourly. It just wouldn't seem right if we did it in the sunshine.
Well, Tinian said, rising to his feet, I suppose we might as well get started.
Aren't we going to eat breakfast first? Calton objected.
You really don't want anything in your stomach, Calton, Tinian replied.
Believe me, you don't.
They walked out into the field.
They don't seem to have been doing as much digging here, Beirut said, looking around.
Maybe the Zamoks don't know where the Thalesians are buried after all.
We can hope, Tinian said.
I guess this is as good a place to start as any.
He picked up a dead stick and prepared to draw a diagram on the sodden ground.
Use this instead, Sophrenia advised, handing him a coil of rope. A diagram drawn on dry ground is all right, but there are puddles here, and the ghosts might not see the whole thing.
We really wouldn't want that to happen, Tinian agreed.
He began to lay out the rope on the ground. The design was a strangely compelling one with obscure curves and circles and irregularly shaped stars.
Is that about right? He asked Sophrenia.
Move that one slightly to the left, she said, pointing.
He did that.
Much better, she said. Repeat the spell out loud. I'll correct you if you do anything wrong.
Just out of curiosity, why don't you do this, Sophrenia? Calton asked her. You seem to know more about it than anybody.
I'm not strong enough, she admitted. What you're really doing in this ritual is wrestling with the dead to compel them to rise. I'm a little small for that sort of thing.
Tinian began to speak in Styric, intoning the words sonorously.
There was a peculiar cadence to his speech, and the gestures he made had a slow stateliness to them.
His voice grew louder and more commanding. Then he raised both his hands and brought them together sharply. At first, nothing seemed to happen. Then, the ground inside his diagram seemed to ripple and shudder. Slowly, almost painfully, something rose from the earth.
God!
Colton gasped in horror as he stared at the grotesquely mutilated thing.
Talk to it, Euleth, Tinian said from between clenched teeth. I can't hold it here very long.
Euleth stepped forward and began to speak in a harshly guttural language. Old Thalesian, Sophronia identified the dialect. Common soldiers at the time of King Sarek would have spoken it. The ghastly apparition replied haltingly in a dreadful voice. Then it made a jerky pointing motion with one bony hand.
Let it go back, Tinian, Euleth said. I've got what we need.
Tinian's face was gray and his hands were shaking. He spoke two words in Styric, and the apparition sank back into the earth.
That one didn't really know anything, Euleth told them, but it pointed out the spot where an earl is buried. The earl was in the household of King Sarek, and if anyone around here knows where the king's buried, he would. It's right over there.
Let me get my breath first, Tinian said.
Is it really that difficult?
You have no idea, my friend. They waited while Tinian stood gasping painfully. After a few moments, he coiled up his rope and straightened.
All right, let's go wake up the Earl.
Euleth led them to a small knoll that stood nearby.
Burial mound, he said. It's customary to raise one when you bury a man of importance.
Tinian laid out his design atop the mound, then stepped back and began the ritual again. He finished it and clapped his hands once more. The apparition that rose from the mound was not as hideously mutilated as the first had been. It was dressed in traditional Thalesian chainmail and had a horned helmet on its head.
Who art thou who hast disturbed my sleep? It demanded of Tinian in the archaic speech of 5 centuries past. He hath brought thee once again into the light of day at my urging, my lord, Euleth replied. I am of thy race and would speak with thee. Speak quickly, then. I am discontent that thou hast done this thing. We seek the resting place of His Majesty King Sarek, Euleth said. Knowest thou, my lord, where we might search? His Majesty doth not lie on this battlefield, the ghost responded.
Sparhawk's heart sank.
Knowest thou what befell him? Euleth pressed. His Majesty departed from his capital at Emsat when word reached him of the invasion of Otha's hordes, the ghost declared. He took with him a small party of his household retainers. The rest of us remained behind to marshal the main force. We were to follow when the army was gathered. When we arrived here, His Majesty was nowhere to be found. None here knoweth what befell him. Seek ye therefore elsewhere. One last question, my lord, Euleth said. Knowest thou, perchance, which route it was His Majesty's intention to follow to reach this field? He sailed to the north coast, sir knight. No man, alive or dead, knoweth where he made landfall and disembarked. Seek ye therefore in Pelosia or Deira, and return me to my rest. Our thanks, my lord, Euleth said with a formal bow. Thy thanks have no meaning for me, the ghost said indifferently. Let him go back, Tinian, Euleth said sadly.
Once again Tinian released the spirit, as Sparhawk and the others stood looking at each other, their faces filled with chagrin. Chapter 9. Euleth walked over to where Tinian sat on the wet ground with his head between his hands.
Are you all right? He asked.
Sparhawk had noticed that the huge, savage Thalesian was strangely gentle and solicitous with his companions.
I just feel a little tired, that's all, Tinian replied weakly.
You can't keep doing this, you know, Euleth told him.
I can hold out for a little longer.
Teach me the spell, Euleth urged. I can wrestle with the best, alive or dead.
Tinian smiled wanly.
I'll wager that you could, my friend. Have you ever been bested?
Not since I was about 7, Euleth said modestly.
That was when I crammed my older brother's head into the wooden well bucket. It took our father 2 hours to get him out of it. My brother's ears got caught. He always had those big ears. I sort of miss him. He came out second best in a fight with an ogre. The big man looked at Sparhawk. All right, he said. Now what? We certainly can't search all of northern Pelosia or Deira, Colton said. That's fairly obvious, Sparhawk replied. We don't have time. We've got to get more precise information somehow. Favier, can you think of anything that might give us a clue of where to look? The accounts of this part of the battle are very sketchy, Sparhawk, the white-cloaked knight replied dubiously. He smiled at Euleth. Our Genidian brothers are a bit lax in keeping records. Writing in runes is tedious, Euleth confessed, particularly on stone. Sometimes we let those things slide for a generation or so. I think we need to find a village or a town of some sort, Sparhawk, Keurig said. Oh? We've got a lot of questions, and we aren't going to get the answers unless we ask somebody. Keurig, the battle was 500 years ago, Sparhawk reminded him. We're not going to find anybody alive who saw what happened. Of course not. But sometimes local people, particularly commoners, keep track of an area's traditions. And landmarks have names. The name of a mountain or a stream could be just the clue we need.
It's worth a try, Sparhawk, Sifrania said seriously. We're not getting anywhere here.
It's very slim, Sifrania.
What other options do we have?
We'll keep going north then, I suppose.
And probably past all the excavations, she added. If the ground's been plowed over, it's a fairly sure sign that Belium's not there.
That's true, I suppose. All right, we'll go on north, and if something promising turns up, Tinian can raise another ghost. Euleth looked dubious at that. I think we'll have to be careful there, he said. Just the effort of raising these two almost put him on his back.
I'll be all right, Tinian protested weakly.
Of course you will. At least you would be if we had time to let you rest in bed for several days. They helped Tinian into his saddle, pulled his blue cape around him, and rode north in the continuing drizzle. The city of Rondera stood on the east shore of the lake. It was surrounded by high walls, and there were grim watchtowers at each corner. Well, Colton said, looking speculatively at the bleak Lamarck city. Waste of time, Keurig grunted. He pointed at a large mound of dirt slowly melting down in the rain. We're still coming across diggings. We need to go farther north.
Sparhawk looked critically at Tinian. Some of the color had returned to the Alcyone knight's face, and he seemed to be slowly recovering. Sparhawk nudged Farron into a canter and led his friends through the dreary landscape. It was mid-afternoon by the time they passed the last signs of excavations. There's some kind of a village down there by the lake, Sir Sparhawk, Beirut said, pointing.
It's probably not a bad place to start. Sparhawk agreed. Let's see if we can find an inn down there. I think it's time for us to have a hot meal, get in out of the rain, and dry out for a bit anyway. And a tavern, perhaps, Colton added. People in taverns usually like to talk, and there are always a few old men around who pride themselves on how well they know local history.
They rode on down to the shore of the lake and into the village. The houses were uniformly run down, and the cobbled streets were in disrepair. At the lower end of town, a series of docks protruded out into the lake, and there were nets hanging on poles along the shore. The smell of long-dead fish permeated the air in the narrow streets. A suspicious-eyed villager directed them to the only inn the village had, a very old, sprawling stone building with a slate roof. Sparhawk dismounted in the inn yard and went inside. A fat man with a bright red face and raggedly cut hair was rolling a beer barrel across the floor toward a wide door near the back. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.